Welcome to Erev Tov. Welcome to part two of the story behind the writing of Shulchan Aruch here at Westside Sephardic Synagogue. And we're thank you again to
the Rosens, to Daniel, for hosting this special event. And let's do a little bit of chazara, a little bit of review from last week. Okay, so we discussed. Let's put everything into perspective. Okay, we have the Talmud, which is written. Anyone know when the Talmud's finished? Talmud is finished around
500,
600 CE, and it's discussions. Right? There's no clarification of how one is supposed to follow in terms of halacha. And the Gemara is written in Bavel, which today is Iraq. That's where the Gemara is composed. And world Jewry, that is the center of world Jewry, Bavel. But eventually, by the time you get to the 1000s, world Jewry is refocused and recentered in two areas. It's Ashkenaz, in northern France and Germany, and Sfarad, in Spain. And, of course, there are also Jews in North Africa and other areas, but these are the two really strongly emerging and strengthening Jewish communities. And each of these communities developed different ways of interpreting halacha and different methodologies of interpreting halacha. So you have the Sfaradim, who for the most part follow the Gaonim. And the way the Gaonim, again, we spoke about the example from last week. You have Lamare versus, what was it, Prime Gro? Was that our example?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when you have two different sources that contradict each other, do we, the Gaonim and the Rambam and the Rif, two very key figures here, the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfazi, who wrote the Halachot, and the Rambam, who wrote the Mishneh Torah, both of them would say, if you have Lamare, one source says Lamare is better, the other source says that Prime Girl is better, that one is right, one is wrong, and we throw out the one that's wrong, and we follow the one that's right. Very simple. We cut it out, and we follow this position. Whereas the Ashkenazim, their Talmidei Chachamim were known as the Baalei Tosafot, right? Because they were the children and grandchildren and progeny of Rashi, and they are adding Tosafot, additions to Rashi's commentary. They had a dialectical method of Talmud study. They do not reject one source over another. They say, wait a second, both of these sources can be true, depends on the circumstance. Lamare is best in this instance. Prime Grill is better in this way, right? And they would try to maintain
harmony.
The harmony of the source. They would try to find harmony between the sources while maintaining that both of them are true.
But we see in the Gemara use that. When there are discrepancy between two Mishnayot,
yes,
or two Braytot,
excellent,
very good. The Gemara used the,
so
oh,
people,
this.
So the Baalei Tosafot expand. They expand upon the process that already begins in the Gemara. It's an expansion of the Gemara, no question. They're continuing the Talmudic discussions. They're expanding the Talmud. They're bringing about contradictions or debates that the Talmud itself doesn't bring about. Okay, it's a continuation. Nachon. Those are the two methods. And each of these communities developed their different ways of, you know, actual practical halacha. And then we get to the 16th century. We have a person by the name of Rav Yosef Caro, who's born in Spain. And his life very much captures, it mirrors some of the developments, larger developments in the Jewish world. Because his family is kicked out of Spain, they go to Portugal. Kicked out of Portugal. So where do they go? Along with many other emigres, as Spanish people who were expelled, they go to the Ottoman Empire. And one of the primary cities in the Ottoman Empire, where Jews are building, rebuilding, is Tzfat, is the city of Safed, in the northern Galil, overlooking the Kinneret. And he gets there, and he spends... He's one of the great rabbis there. He's involved in the rebirth of emergence of Jewish learning and Jewish messianism is a play, and this is the time of the Lecha Dodi and all these things, right? And he's a great Talmudic scholar, and he realizes that Torah scholarship is vanishing in the world; it's weakening, and furthermore, nobody knows what to do. There's so many different halachic manuals out there, nobody knows what to follow halacha l'maaseh. And then there are some practical books, but the practical books don't tell you where anything is. So if you read this practical book, one of them that he didn't like in particular was called the Agur, the Sefer HaAgur. And you look it up and it says, do this, you know, do X, Y, Z. But you don't know where this is in the Talmud, and you don't know what the Rishonim say, and everything is a mess, you can't find anything. So what does he do? He creates, he writes a massive, he starts a massive work. And what is this work called? What's it called, his work from last week?
The Beit Yosef.
The Beit Yosef. The Beit Yosef, the House of Joseph. And the House of Joseph is a massive encyclopedic work that includes all of the, he bases it off of another work by the name of the Turim, the Arba'at Turim by Rav Yaakov ben Asher. Rav Yaakov ben Asher is the son of Rabbeinu Asher. Rabbeinu Asher was one of the Ashkenazim, and he bases it from an organizational standpoint. He uses the Turim and he builds off of that. So the Turim quotes a few different opinions for each halacha, and he reorganized halacha into four different main areas of halacha, right? Four different columns, the Arba'at Turim. And now, and we spoke about this last time, this was the Turim on this page of the, okay? The Turim is the one in the middle. That's the Turim in the middle. The Beit Yosef, you see, I put it in a box this time, you see the Beit Yosef is on top. It's the commentary on the right side, the column. Okay, we're going to study some of this today, so you will see this all in action. So that he decides to write the Beit Yosef and to collect all of the opinions from the time of the Gemara all the way through the Rishonim and the Rambam and the Rosh and over 30 different scholars and works, and he collects everything in one place, and he wants to give you all of the everything that's there, so you could have it in one location. And he even tries to give you the halacha lemaaseh at the end of it. And that's called, this work is called the Beit Yosef. And we studied it last week. We studied the sugya of, are you allowed to reply or say hi to a person who walks into shul during Shema? And we discussed it. We saw how he quotes all the opinions and back and forth. And we see how he expands upon and brings. Now, his method of psak, though, is very innovative. How does he determine halacha?
And he has three major Rishonim.
Yeah.
You want to open the door?
Depends on the, yeah.
You want to open the door?
Okay, yeah. Three major what?
So three major Rishonim, and it goes by the majority of it. So that's
Exactly. So he takes the three greatest scholars. Who are the three greatest scholars, or a compendia of Jewish law? It's the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher. He takes two out of the three. It's like majority wins. You know, that's basically the way it works.
You're talking about Beit Yosef?
The Beit Yosef. That's how he determines halacha.
But so there are four sources in Beit Yosef? So there's the Rif, the Rosh, and the Rambam.
And the Rambam. That's how he determines halacha. So the Beit Yosef quotes everything.
Four? Number four is what is his...
Now, the Beit Yosef quotes everything. Okay. He quotes everything, but he follows the halacha based on the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. Remember, it's encyclopedic. It includes everything, the Beit Yosef. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see in just a, you know, we're going to look at it again about how it works, how the Beit Yosef works inside. Now, so he quotes everything, but he follows the majority of those three. Okay? Now, if I were to ask you, how do we paskin halacha today? What would you answer? How does a rabbi paskin halacha today? How does he determine Jewish law? What does he do? Does he pick two of the three greatest commentators of the last generation?
Well, first he starts with the Shulchan Aruch.
He's early Shulchan Aruch, yeah.
And then you see what applies in his time.
Okay.
And sometimes he would go to a minority opinion that was neglected, because in his time, things are different, and we can use that.
I
would say he goes by who he's persuaded by.
Who he's persuaded by? Or what else? What are other options for what he can do? He can go by whatever the current practice is, whatever people are doing.
The minhag.
Whatever the minhagim are, right? Whatever current practice is. What the Beit Yosef is suggesting is it's a textual process. It's an you're going back to the sources and studying what the sources say, and paskin based on the sources. Whereas some other methods might be, what's happening? What do we see around us? What are Jews doing? You know, what's the current minhag? We're gonna see this come into play. Yeah.
That one worked, though, for new things.
For what?
new issues.
New issues. Yeah, you're right. It might not work for new issues.
Correct.
It might not work for new issues. Correct. So this is the Shulchan Aruch. This is the Beit Yosef. We don't even know what the Shulchan Aruch is yet. We have no idea what the Shulchan Aruch is. We just know what the Beit Yosef is. Beit Yosef, everyone understand what the Beit Yosef is? Yafeh, we got it down pat. Beit Yosef, huge encyclopedic work of Jewish law. Okay, and you see it on the page. I mean, it's a massive undertaking, okay? See, this is the tour, very small, but he keeps going on and on. He writes a lot, okay? Now we're going to see what's happening in another place, in another time, in a place called Krakow, Poland. Krakow, Poland. Now, there's no internet at this time, and there's no long-distance telephone cables. So, what's going to happen here is, we're going to see what happens in just a little bit. But here's where the story gets really interesting. Let's read about someone by the name of Rav Moshe Isserles. Rav Moshe Isserles lived from 1525, to 1565. Okay, maybe a little bit longer than that, 1575. Okay, he lives for about 50 years, okay, in a place called Krakow, Poland. Has anybody here been to Krakow? Yeah? Very often when you go to on Jewish heritage tours to Poland, you go visit Krakow, which had 80,000 Jews, if I'm not mistaken, before the Holocaust. And you can go to the shul of Rav Moshe Isserles, the Ramaz shul. You can go to his shul. And you can see in the back of his Beit Knesset is his kever. And there's a tree, a huge tree by his kever. Someone else by the name of the Beit Chadash, who's actually the commentator right here, is also, Rav Yoel Sirkis is also buried right there. Okay, it's all in Krakow, Poland. And now we're going to read about this guy, Rav Moshe Isserles from Krakow, Poland. Let's read his Hakdama to a work that he's going to call the Darche Moshe, the Ways of Moshe. So let's read this inside. Ish hu bekarka ushmo Yisrael. There was a man in Krakow, and his name was Israel. Asher nadvarucho ubana beit knesset lakel. Who was magnanimous, and he donated a Beit Knesset to the community. This is a guy named Yisrael. V'ani b'no Moshe, and I am his son Moshe. Na'ar hayiti v'adayin lo zakanti. I'm still young, I'm not even old. Karmi shelo lo natarti. I haven't pruned my own vineyard yet, okay? I'm still young. V'al echarim mitmaneti. And yet I was appointed over others. I fell into a leadership position. That's what he's saying. L'harot l'rabim derech yalchubo ul'tamid katonti. In order to educate people about what to do. Meaning people started asking him halachic questions. He's a great scholar. They start asking him questions. And they're asking him questions, and I put dot, dot, dot here because I wasn't going to go through the whole story. They're asking him questions, and he would usually quote from the basic sources, the Talmud, and the Rif, and the Rambam, and Rabbeinu Asher. And people then said, but what about all these more contemporary poskim, and this and that? And he said there was so much information out there, so what did he have to do? He said he had no time. He had to write these answers to people. He had to answer people's questions. And there was so much information, and he didn't have the time, the wherewithal, to collect all of it and to answer their questions properly. V'lo ha'li tachbula li'natzel, I had no way of getting out of this. Be'iyun kol advarim she'archu kema'atzel la'atzel v'chi ha'malacham ruba b'yamim u'tim v'ani ha'po'el la'atzel. I have no time, I'm busy, there's so much work to do. U'baruch, and then he comes up with an idea. And what's his idea? U'baruch hu ha'misayeh ha'kol ha'balitaher. Patach li'char, God opened for me a gate. He says, I came up with this brilliant idea. I'm going to take all of the commentaries, all of the things written by Jewish scholars, medieval Jewish scholars from the time of the Talmud, and I'm going to organize them, and I'm going to summarize them, and I'm going to collect them. This path, which is indeed light, I will organize things in my mind. I decided to reorganize it, organize everything together that had been written in the last few hundred years. I decided I would write it based on another book. And lo and behold, what book does he choose? V'ra'iti she'ein tov mizeh la sefer haturim. I saw that the best book to use for this is a book called the Sefer HaTorim. Now, who wrote the Sefer HaTorim? We've already gone through this. Rav Yaakov ben Asher.
The Rosh's son.
Okay? Ki b'divreihem b'seder na'im b'sudarim. It's very organized. Uvekal afshar limtso b'mevakshu b'vukashu af achad mina b'vorim heina zekinin hein na'arim deze hayu advarim b'li b'itz fonim u'shmurim. Anybody who wants to look up something, they could find it because it's very organized and it's helpful. It's a good organizational tool. Umiyad et matandi, okay, v'nezarti, umishanti tardimatai ninarti, umeezer yoshev t'lot nezarti. I woke up from my sleep and I started working. God gave me help. Shemachshvotai itchalti v'kimat gamarti. I almost finished my work. I spent so much time on this. V'kol chidushei aposkim v'teshuvot b'yachar chibarti. I brought everything together. It's all organized. V'seder ba'al haturim b'hen sadarti. Velo shalveti, velo shaketeti, shakateti. I didn't sleep, I didn't rest. V'im yashanti az yanuach li, v'zeh hayachal ki b'kol yimei amali. This was my work, this was my life's work. Uve'ezer ha'uzi ha'imiti asita davar b'li shehut ichtov kol ha'chidushin b'tzat ha'tur la'hag'ot, v'ifamim ha'veti gam ken sh'ar deot. And he said, I worked hard to bring every opinion to build off the tour. Okay? And now listen what happens. Uvahagia Tor Esther, Rotzelumar Isur Veheter. This is a reference to Purim and when the time of Esther came to see Achashverosh, and when I got to the halachot of Isur Veheter, the laws of Kashrut, the itchalti hilchot chala, and I started the laws of chala. Achazani platzod v'levishani chal chala, b'shom'i ner Yisrael rosh hokala. I started shaking. I started panicking. I started getting, bumps all over me. When I heard that the Neri saw the light of Israel, Rosh HaGolah, the head of the exile, Ari Misabcho Allah, the lion, woke up from his den, El Shamayim V'ruach Aleihem Kadishim B'Chafenu Asaf, V'Chiber Sefer Beit Yosef. I heard that the lion, the great scholar of the Jewish people, wrote a book called the Beit Yosef. Asher Kolro Av Yadun and Ma'alatov et Tovo, Vrubo Tovo at Savun Bikrbo. Everyone knows the greatness of this work. As Nivhalti, I trembled. I was stricken. Shepoal Harek Pa'alti. I spent all my time.
For nothing.
For nothing on this useless work. Vishayagati Larek Vala, Vishinati Bikinami, many Gazati. My sleep was stolen from me for no good reason. Vela Neor Azei Pa'alti. Says, how could I hold up anything to this guy? What a great scholar. This work, the Beit Yosef, he recognized the Beit Yosef is better than anything that he could have compiled himself. Okay, and he's so upset. Okay, the Beit Yosef covered everything. He's like, my life work, it's worthless, compared
to... He did it better.
He wrote
most of it, and it's already been outdated. It's already been outdone.
I understand, but at the time he writes this, he already read what he wrote, or he just heard of that he...
He clearly got, saw it. Okay. Yeah.
So when he started doing this job, he did not know about it.
He didn't know about it. And what's fascinating is that he had the same idea as the Beit Yosef. He wanted to do the same thing as the Rav Yosef Karo. Mm-hmm. But one was in Poland, the other one's in Sfat. And they realized that there was the same need. And so they work on the same process, but one didn't know about the other. So the Rama is writing this work and he's doing all this, and he realizes that that his work is just not going to meet the standard. It's already been outshined. It's outshone, outdone. So
his name is Moshe what?
Rav Moshe Isserles.
Isserles?
Aleph, Yud, Samech, Reish, Reish, Lamed, Yud, Samech.
Okay.
And he goes by the abbreviation. Anyone know what it is? Anyone know what the abbreviation Rama. For the Rama? Reish Memal, right?
Okay.
Okay. Oh.
Sephardim also call him Muram.
Say again?
Muram. Right? Yeah, Maram is our teacher. Moresh Lahan. Maram is our teacher.
Now listen to this. He goes through a state of depression. Okay? It's like very sad for him. I was confused for days. Mm-hmm. I had no rest. My heart melted within me. And then I prayed to Hashem. And I said, Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, help me. He said, help me, through this. Shelo you kol divrei genuzim.
This is we just read that in Daniel, it's like Esav asking to
And he said, help me, Hashem, so that my work, my life's work, will not go, be meaningless. And it worked. My tefillah worked, and God shone. He showed me the light, as it was clear what I had to do. Clear as the sun. Okay, let me just go down. And he realized that there was something missing, there was something lacking in the works of the Beit Yosef. There are two major things that are lacking in the work of the Beit Yosef. First of all, the Beit Yosef quotes all the opinions, but it's still not condensed enough. He doesn't quote a summary of them. He'll quote their whole opinion. Okay, so first of all, he's going to quote opinions in a more condensed way. That's one. The second thing is that he realizes the Beit Yosef, who is the Beit Yosef good for?
Sephardic.
The Beit Yosef is Sephardic centric. Okay, we live in a world where a lot of things are Ashkenazi centric. Okay, the Beit Yosef is Sephardic centric. If you're Ashkenazi and you want to know what your halachot are for Jews in Germany and Ashkenaz, where are you supposed to turn? You're going to go to the Rif and the Rambam? Those are not your poskim. You want to know about the Rosh. You want to know about all the great scholars. And there were many great scholars from the times of the Balei Tosafot, medieval Ashkenaz. Okay, by the way, you know how Jews got to Poland? Anyone know? How did Jews get to Poland? They traveled, but how'd they get to Poland?
From Germany?
Jews were kicked out of France and Germany in France in the 1200s, and then Germany, the 1300s.
The 1400s. So
they then go to Poland, right? I think a lot of it was because of the bubonic plague, the Black Plague. So they're kicked out of these places, so they go further east, and that's how Jews get to Poland, right? So let's go to the next paragraph. He's going to explain the real deficiency in the Beit Yosef. והשלישית הוא העיקר, והוא התכלית המבוקש בזה המחקר, כי ידוע שהרב המחבר בית יוסף, בטיבו אל הגדולים נחשף, the Beit Yosef only cared about the three great ones, the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rabbeinu Asher. ופסק הלכה בכל מקום הפי שני ושלושה עדים, he always follows just two or three opinions. הם הגאונים הנחמדים, הריף והרמם והראש, he always follows the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. בכל מקום, ששניים מהם לדעת הכה נצמדים, לשאר הרב תאדיר את הרלוח השלהם. He forgot all the other great sages in between. Rak b'makom gdolim amad livsok alachat k'divrei shneihem. V'af kihim kamay v'lo batshray v'lo chash l'divarim shetzav chubo kamay d'kamay alo harif shepasak sof perek bet d'eirvin v'iskim umor abim livsok alachat v'lo chamokom k'batshray v'lo lachush l'divrei kamay v'afilu b'makom rav etzila tamid. And now the Rama is going to explain, well, what's his method for determining halacha? And he disagrees with the Shulchan Aruch's method. Because the method of the Rav Moshe Israelis is called halacha kibatrai. What's halacha kibatrai? It means halacha always follows the later opinion. We follow the later opinion. If you have a student who argues on his rabbi, we follow him. We follow the student. Because we assume that he's seen more material, he has more knowledge, he's seen more of the sources. We follow the later opinion. We always follow the last opinion. Not the first. The Shulchan Aruch wanted to go back to the Rambam, go back to the Rif, right? Reestablishing is based on the three great ones.
But who follows the later opinion?
The Rama. Okay. Rav Moshe Israelis.
Oh, okay.
So he didn't believe in the whole...
He didn't like this two out of three...
The closer you are to Sinai, the more accurate you are.
That's true.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point that, but this is one of the reasons, by the way, it's a good point, that the Talmud Bavli is more accepted than the Talmud Yerushalmi. One explanation is because it's Batrai. It was written later. So we assume...
They have more stuff to look at.
Exactly. If the Talmud Bavli says one thing and it disagrees with the Talmud Yerushalmi, It means that it saw it and disagreed with it, and there's reason for it, right? It's a later work, so we follow the later opinions. We assume also maybe it's that it's about the contemporary perspectives, you know, the poskim in your generation know more about your situation than the poskim of the previous generation, right? So they're following based on what they see in within their own generation.
Karamban doesn't follow that, though, either. Right, he'll say that if there are two people who disagree, then you follow the one who makes more sense to you, regardless if it's Ben Arishon or Ben Aharon.
He's a rationalist.
So I don't... No, but I don't... I can't say that I know enough about his method of psak, the Rambam. It's not clear... I don't always know how he... I mean, how... I think they're like, you know, they're almost like these, you know, you have two, you know, Rava and Rabba, we always follow one over the other. It's that type of thing, usually. Abaye and, you know...
Sorry, he's referring to post... Because that's what he says in the Hakdama.
That what? Do you always follow?
He says if you have two people who make a ruling, and one person sides one way, one person, and later another person sides another way, that you don't follow necessarily the later one or the earlier one, or rather the one who makes more sense.
Yeah, how do you determine what makes more sense? But maybe you're right. Yeah, it could be. It could be that's
that
what he does.
That is a question.
Yeah.
How does anyone determine?
Say again?
How does anyone determine? Gotta choose.
No. You're right. Okay, so he's saying, though, that the... So that's what he's going to do. He's going to follow the halakha kipatrai, especially for people in Germany, for Ashkenazim. Let's go to the second to last line in this paragraph. The Rambam has forgotten about... not the Rambam. The Beit Yosef has ignored all the minhagim in Ashkenaz for Ashkenazi Jews. And so he's going to quote all the opinions that the Beit Yosef leaves out, the local minhagim of the Ashkenazim and the Tzurfatim. That's what he's going to do. That's going to be his addition to the Beit Yosef. Okay, and he's going to call this work Darkei Moshe, the way of Moshe. Okay? Does that make sense? Everyone understand what happens here? Now, what's fascinating is that we have two... The same process occurs to the Rama and Rav Yosef Karo. That they realize the same need, and they both want to compile encyclopedic works to capture everything. But then we have this devastating story of the Rama being, you know... It's like, wasn't there someone also who figured out evolution near around the time that Darwin did, but you know, one makes the history books, the other one, you know, is well, forgotten history.
Happened to Leibniz and Euler, I think.
Newton.
Oh, Newton. Yes, yeah. That's right.
And who got credit for it? Newton.
More so Newton, I think.
No. It happened a bunch of times in history, and you know, as Victor writes history in a sense, you know. So, okay. Let's now go on. Now we're going to skip 10 years. We're going to get to 10 years later. Okay? Anyone here ever read The Three Musketeers? There's a book, like the third one, there's The Three Musketeers, and then there's The Man in the Iron Mask, and then there's like 10 years later, and then 20 years later. So 10 years later. 10 years later.
Where did he write this? Where, in which place does he...
In Krakow. This is Krakow, Poland.
No, but where
this is the Hakdama, the introduction.
Oh, okay.
To the...
Darkei Moshe?
Yeah. Now, and just notice, by the way, that it's on here on the bottom of the page, Darkei Moshe. So we're going to read it inside, okay? We're going to see what he does. We're not... you know what? Let's do that now. Let's see this inside. Let's see how the Beit Yosef, the Torah, the Beit Yosef, and the Darkei Moshe work. Okay, and we'll see, we'll get it, we'll get to see it inside. Now, what I did for you this week is, so we're looking at the Beit Yosef on Siman Taf Reish Ayin Aleph Halacha Bet. And I decided to pick something
it's
related to Chanukah.
Appropriate for this season, right?
Inyan Idioma. So we're going to go from one source to the other, and what I did differently this time, as you notice, I put boxes around the name of the source, you see that? Mm-hmm. And circles around the opinions that they quote. Okay, so let's actually start. The truth is, we should actually start in the Gemara.
Because I let's go to page 3 of your source sheet. Actually, let's go to page 3 of your source sheet.
So the Bet Yosef quotes the Tosfot.
If this.
The Bet Yosef quotes the Tosfot.
Yes. He quotes everything,
including the Ashkenazim.
He does. He quotes the Balei Tosfot, but not the. Yeah, he does quote them, but he never follows them. He never follows them, and the exceptions.
Only he follows them if the Rosh happens to follow them. Yeah. That's usually how it works.
If there's no. If there's no majority rule, if you cannot use the 2 out of 3.
The reality is that the majority rule thing doesn't always work. He even writes it in here. That this whole majority rule thing, like, you know, they don't know, it doesn't play out that way in practice. But, okay. Let's study Neirot Chanukah. And we're going to see this. So first we'll start with, we always start with the Gemara, right? And now you're going to be able to see the layers in a sugya. I hope that you'll really see the development of halacha in this. So we're starting with the Gemara on page 3. I broke up the Gemara into, I've made bullet points to make it a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. So Tanu Rabbanan, we're right here. Masachat Shabbat, yeah. Uh-huh. Masachat Shabbat, Davkav Bet Amud Aleph. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis teach us. Mitzvat Chanukah Ner Ish Uveito. The mitzvah of lighting Chanukah candles is one candle per household. Okay? This is the most basic way to fulfill the mitzvah of Chanukah. To just light one candle. Okay? How many candles would you light after all of Chanukah?
Eight.
One candle per night. Very simple. Okay? The hamahadrin ner lekol echad ve'echad. And if you, what's mehadrin? What does that mean? Mehadir, one who wants to beautify, adorn the mitzvah, should light one candle per person. Okay? That means, let's say we were a family and we were lighting Hanukkah candles. How many Hanukkah, that's the first night, how many Hanukkah candles would we light?
5 per night, 40.
5. How many would light the second night?
Also the same number.
5. Eighth night? 7. 5. We'd always light 5.
We've already mehadrin.
Okay. V'amahadrin mina mehadrin. However, the beautiful, you know, the highest of the highest, of the high, there's a debate. The numbers are the same, but the order and how you would do it is debated. So Beit Shammai Omrin, Beit Shammai says, the first day you light, Yom Rishon Madlik Shmona, the first day you light 8, Mikan ve'elach, from this day onward, you go down. You 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Whereas Beit Hillel says, on the first day, Yom Rishon Madlik Achad, the first day you light 1, and then you get up to 8. Which opinion do we follow?
Ma'alin be-mitzvah.
Yeah, we follow the opinion of Beit Hillel. We go up. Okay? Now, here is the million-dollar question. You notice that there are 3 levels here. There's 1, 2, 3, right? So if I'm following number 3, and it's all 5 of us, how many candles would we light in the first night?
So everybody would do 1.
Okay, so we'd have 5 all together on the first night. How many would we do on the second night?
That'd be 10.
We would do 10. Okay, third night?
15.
And last night, how many would we have?
A lot of candles.
8, we'd have 40 candles. Okay, 40 candles.
Yeah, it's a lot.
What's the problem with having... If we were to light 40 candles.
It's a dangerous.
Bed. It's dangerous. That's one issue. That certainly is one issue.
It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. Okay.
I mean, oil is a precious...
What else? Let's say you have the money for it. $10 worth of candles. What else is the problem?
I get confused.
Say again?
I get confused.
About what?
Who's lighting what?
Okay, you get confused who's lighting what. You're getting closer, getting warmer. What's the problem?
A passerby doesn't know what night it is?
Yeah, yeah. If someone were to walk by, you know, let's say the person across from here sees you light 40 candles, what night, what are they going to think? What night of Hanukkah is it?
Maybe 4th and you have 10 people.
Say again? Maybe it's the 4th night you have 10 people, right? Or, you know, there could be... And they're probably not even going to count all them anyway, so it doesn't matter. But they're going to just see a blob of candles, right?
Somebody's having a birthday.
They're going to have no idea what night of Chanukah it is.
Whereas if you have one big, you know, one menorah, that and that you know, when there are three candles, it's the third night, four, fourth night, five, fifth night, right? So this is the, this idea that there's a problem of getting confused by the numbers, okay?
Does
by
it
the
matter?
Is well, the Baalei Tosafot think that it matters. So let's see Tosafot on the Gemara, okay? What did the Tosafot say? Nira Liri. Ri is one of the Baalei Tosafot. Baalei Tosafot are many different people. Nira Liri is Rabbeinu Yitzchak. The Beit Shammai uVeit Hillel lo kaimi ela aner ish uBeito. According to Rabbeinu Yitzchak, the third opinion of Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, that does not build off of the second stage. It's not three is not building off of two. Rather, three is building off of one. So that means that if you want to do Mahadrin, regular Mahadrin, everybody would like, you know, we'd have 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5, right? Mahadrin mina Mahadrin is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We could have 50 people here or one person here. And we just do 1 through 8.
So meaning, the first night, the Mahadrin mina Mahadrin is less light than the Mahadrin.
If it depends.
On the first night.
On the first night, the Mehadrin mina Mehadrin have less candle than just the Mehadrin.
Yes, correct.
That's
correct. Well, maybe one. It's not just about quantity.
It's about the idea that you have.
Exactly.
What is your
it's not just about quantity. So Tosafot say, and what's the reason for this? Sheken yesh yoter hidur d'ike heker keshemosif olechom mechaser. There's more hidur, there's more beauty when you know what number it is for each night, right? To know. And why is it more important to know the number? Why is it so important to know the number of the night? Because the whole point is that the candle lasted another day, and then another day, 6 days, 7 days, 8 days, right? So we care about the days, the addition of each day. Mm-hmm. So that is the opinion of the Baalei Tosafot, that number three, Mahadrin mina Mahadrin, is an extension of number one. So once you have, you know, we'll call it standard, regular one, you can go to two, or you can go to three. But they're moving in separate directions, they're not built off each other. Let's now go to the Rambam. The Rambam is going to interpret like you guys interpreted. Kama neiro tu madik b'chanukah. How many candles should a person light on Chanukah? Mitzvata, the basic mitzvah. Sheyakob bayit u bayit madik ner achad. Every family needs to light one. Whether you have a lot of people, no people, it's one candle per night. Oh, we're still in the Rambam on that sheet.
Oh, I wasn't
okay, you see
yeah,
where you see the Rambam?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's the Rambam.
So originally, that's what they were doing, people? They were.
I don't know if anyone ever followed this, but if you only had enough money for one, then that's what you would do.
Okay. Okay?
But if somebody wants to add to the mitzvah, if you want to add to the mitzvah, then you light one for every person in the household each night. 5, 5, 5, 5, 5. Right? That's number two. Now the question is, how is he going to understand Mahadrin mina Mahadrin? If you want to do the exemplary, the choice mitzvah, madlik ner lekol echad balayla harishon. Umosif veholech v'kolayla v'layla ner echad. You light every person for the first night. We'd all light one candle. Then the second night, we'd all light two. Then three. Then four. Then five. And six. So according to the Rambam, Mahadrin mina Mahadrin. Is that based off of Mahadrin or is it based on standard? Which one is it? He says it's which one?
From the Mahadrin.
Exactly. Three is built off of two. So the Rambam would say, on the last night of, so let's just think of it in the last night, it's the last night of Chanukah. How many would the Baalei Tosafot say you should do for Mahadrin mina Mahadrin? How many candles would we have altogether?
40.
No, if Tosafot. The Baalei Tosafot, we would
Tosafot,
have,
yeah, yeah.
We would have eight. According to the Rambam, what would we have?
Five.
We would have, no. How many would we
Rambam
have in the last
40.
Night? We would have 40.
Right.
All five of us would light eight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's what he would do for the last night of Chanukah. That's the difference between them. Okay? Good. So, and he gives an example. Ketzara Aresha, you on Shea Bait, that's right. Let's say there are 10 people in the house. The Laila Arishon Madlika Sarnero, the first night they light 10. Then second night, 20. Then 30, 40, 50. The last night, 80, because it's every person goes up from 1 to 8. And then he says, what's the practice here in Sfarad? Minhag Pashut B'chol Arinu B'Sfarad. Our custom here in Sfarad, Sheyu Kol Anshei Abayit Madlikin Ner Echad B'Laila Harishon. Mosifin V'Olchin Ner B'Kol Laila. Ad Shenimtza Madlik B'Lel Shmini Shmona Nerot. He says, however, the custom here in Sfarad is to do the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and that's it. 8 candles on the last night. That's a practical custom.
So one per family. One per family, but every night.
Exactly, exactly. Which for Tosfot is the Mahadrin. Mina Mahadrin. Tosfot is Mina Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin. So the Rambam is interesting here because he's telling us, based on, you know, the Gemara, we really should all be doing 80 on the last night for if you have 10 people, or 5 people, it would be 40. But the custom in Sfarad is to do 8 on the last night. Okay? Now let's move on. We've done the Gemara. We've looked at the Balei Tosafot and the Rambam. There's a debate between the Rambam and the Balei Tosafot. Now let's go to the Torah, the Beit Yosef, and the Darkei Moshe. Okay? Now, let's go to the Torah, which is again the paragraph in the middle. V'kama nero tu madlik. How many candles should a person light? V'lel rishon madlik echad. Mikan ve'elach mosif v'olech echad b'kol layla ad ba'achrona yushmona. A person should light one on the first night, and then two, and the last night, 8. V'afilu im rabim b'nei habayit lo ya'asu yoter. Even if there are more people in the house, you shouldn't do more. You should always do 1 through 8. Whose opinion is that?
Rambam.
That's the Tosfot Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin.
Didn't you say that he said Rambam that in Sfarad?
That's the practice in Sfarad. It's also the practice in Sfarad. But where is the Tur getting this from? He's following the Balei Tosafot because that's what the Balei Tosafot do. Okay? So the Torah says 1 through 8. You could have 20 people, 50 people, it doesn't matter, 1 through 8. Now let's see what the Beit Yosef does. So the Torah, does the Torah give us any opinions here? Does he tell us what the debate is? No, he doesn't tell us anything. He doesn't give us any information. So let's go to the Beit Yosef.
He's adding something that is not in the Gemara with the discussion, or the Tosfot, is that you shouldn't do more.
Yeah. That's right. Because for him, the Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin is 1 through 8.
But is there an Isur?
Oh. Interesting. I mean,
because the Loya Asir Yoter, it's.
Yeah.
This is new. This is a new sentence. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting point. Very good point. Very good reading. Very close.
Okay, everybody wants to do it. Mehadrin Mina Mehadrin Mina Mehadrin.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe right. You think, yeah, he's saying don't do it. It's a very good reading of the Torah. But just can I get the oranges, buddy? Okay. Now let's look at the Beit Yosef. We're looking at the word umidivra. You see the circle of the Rambam? Oh, yeah, thank you. Everyone see this?
Mm-hmm.
So the Beit Yosef is going to obviously quote the two primary opinions here. Because he's collecting everything. Umidivra ha-Rambam nir'eh. According to the Rambam, we see the Mahadrin mina Mahadrin of the Nami Hidu Rishon. The Hainu ner lekol echad ve'achad. That the Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin is building off of the first Hidur. It's 2, 3 is built off of 2. If you want Shabbat, by the Sarab, below Rishon, Madika Sarah Neirot, below Shini, Asrim, below Shishi, Shloshim. First night, 10, if you have 10 people. Then 20, then 30. Aval Tosafot, but the Balei Tosafot, Katfu, Nir Elomar, the Beit Shamayu, Beit Hillel, Lo Kaimi, Ela Aner, Yishu Veito. For according to the Balei Tosafot, the Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin is based off the first option, right? The Ner Yishu Veito. Sheyesh Yoter Hidur De'ike Hekera. There's more Hidur, there's more beauty when you notice, when you know how many, what night it is. Kishemosif Olich O Mechsar Kenegid Amim Nechnism Yotzim. Avalim Yasen Ner Lekol Achad Afil Yosif Leka Hekera. If everybody lights, if we were to light 5, 10, 15, 20, no one would know what night of Chanukah is.
Vinyareh. Now he tells you what we do.
So what he's saying is that if you do more, you're actually doing less. Because by lighting more, you're doing less mitzvah.
Well, that's why they like the idea. They like the idea of the Mahadrin min Mahadrin of 1 through 8. And that's it. Okay? Vinyareh. And he says it appears like Sheha'olam nohagin na'lik balayla rishona ner achad. Our custom is to do one, and then to umosif olech b'chol layla, and we add one each night. Ad shebe'achrona heim shmona, until the last night you have eight. Va'afilu b'nei abayit harbe, even if there are many people, ein amosim yoter da'atam, yoter da'atam gedat tosafot. De'ikar Rambam lama einam osim kemahadrin, imina mahadrin. So what's fascinating here is that it appears like the Beit Yosef is following whose opinion? The Beit Yosef is following the opinion of the Tosfot.
Right.
Right? He's saying this is the custom. He's justifying local custom based on the Tosfot. Okay? Now, the reason I'm showing this Beit Yosef is, first of all, it's related to Chanukah. So it's Yafer, we're learning about Chanukah. The second reason is we see how he collects the two primary opinions. Okay? Oh my God, by the way, I forgot to just show you. Just go up. There's one more circle on the Beit Yosef. You see there's one more circle at the top? That's where he quotes the Gemara itself. So he quotes the Gemara, he quotes the Rambam, he quotes the Tosfot. Everything is here on your page. Now for me personally, I use what's called Bar Ilan in a computer thing. And that's, or the internet. There was no internet then. So he's the one who's collecting everything and putting it together for you, Misudar, in the Beit Yosef. And then he tells you practically that it seems like Jews of his time follow the Mahadrin min Mahadrin of the Balei Tosafot. Okay? Now, let's go down to the bottom, to the
Even the Rambam will agree with that.
Even though, yeah, well, in practice, but not in theory. Yeah, in practice, he says that's what people do, but he seems to think that textually, he likes the Mahadrin min, his version of Mahadrin min Mahadrin.
So like Sephardim for him did a mix between Mahadrin and Mahadrin min Mahadrin.
Yeah. So let's go to the Darkei Moshe. Okay, and we're going to see what the Darkei Moshe does. Okay, because again, what's he going to do? He's generally going to quote the Ashkenazi opinions, so that we see what the Ashkenazim are supposed to do. Okay, v'chein haminhag. So he's commenting on the Beit Yosef. V'katav Maharal miPrag. I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is the Maharal. I think it's the Maharal miPrag, if I'm not mistaken. Usually he's known as the Maharal. I could be wrong about that, but I think it's the Maharal miPrag. Okay, from the Maharal was a, or maybe not, maybe it's not the Maharal. Yeah, I think it is. Morenu Harav, what was it? It was Yehuda Low in English. Can you just look up the Maharal's name? You're right, your phone's, yeah. Okay, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. He's quoting an Ashkenazi, posek Prag, right? Ashkenaz. Tilididan Shemadlikim bifnim, according to us, the Ashkenazim, who light inside the home, meaning in their kitchen, where no one sees. They don't light outside. It was the custom to light your Chanukiah outside. They light inside.
Shemadlikim. Not at the door? At the window?
Not at the window. Not even at the window. Okay, what's the reason? What's the reason they did this? Exactly. It was exactly anti-Semitism, danger. The Gemara says this in Masachet Shabbat Daf Kafal. V'yodin b'bayit kama b'nei adam b'bayit. Everyone knows within the home how many people there are in the home. We know there are five people right here, right? So if we were to all light 40 candles, we would know why there are 40 candles here. The person on the street has no idea. But we know, okay? V'yodin b'bayit kama b'nei adam b'bayit. They would know in the home how many people there are there. V'leka l'mecha shema yomru kach b'nei adam meim b'bayit. And no one would get confused, well, that, why are there 40 candles? Is it 4 times 10? Is it 8 times 5? Af l'dat ha-tosvot mani genu nachon. Even according to Tosvot, our custom is correct. Why? Because Tosvot's concern is that you're going to end up confusing. But if you're not confusing it, so then you should really light, everybody should light 1 through 8 every night. And the last night we have 40 instead of just 8. V'od, and furthermore, the me'achar shemadlikim bifnim kol achad,
Yuchad lahadlik makom yuchad. Because we're all lighting inside. So you could write a light on the mantle. I'll write a light over here in the window. You could write a light on the shelf. That window, that room. Everybody could light somewhere differently. Whereas if it's outside, it's like, you know, there's basically one place to do it by your front door, your chatzer. V'lo ba'i lahadlik kulan betefach ha-samuch lepetach. Not everybody needs a light by the front door. V'nikara anirot shemagdik kol achad ve'achad. Everyone knows what candles they lit. V'ika hekera. There's awareness of whose candles are what. U'kishemosiv olech b'sharlot l'chein manigenu ati shapir l'kuleam. Therefore, our custom is the best of the best. And therefore, their custom in Prague, quoted by the Darkei Moshe, was to for everyone to actually to follow the Rambam's version of the of Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, right?
It must have been so sad when they stopped getting persecuted.
It's a switch, not really. It's not really a switch because they're saying that their opinion really does follow the Balei Tosafot. Because if you have a case where you're lighting inside, then the Balei Tosafot's rationale doesn't apply, right? But you're right. Some people point out there's a switch here. The Ashkenazim, the Svaradim are following the Balei Tosafot, and the Ashkenazim are following the Rambam. Okay, and I brought this here, and to some degree, this actually contradicts what I'm trying to teach you about the methods of the Balin, the Darkei Moshe, the Beit Yosef, that they, you know. But here's an example.
But this is the rational. This is what you said. In this case,
they had like menorah, like Hanukkah. They had Hanukkah.
Mm-hmm.
So how could you be thing? Because if you have like five half Hanukkah and you see
would light in different places.
What I'm saying is, I agree with him.
Yeah.
That you cannot get confused. Mm-hmm. Even in the thing, if you have five Hanukkah and you see two candles in each of them, you know it's night number two or whatever, you know, three or whatever. So, because you have the Hanukkah separated, it's not like all the candles are together.
Mm-hmm. Nachon. It's so that's why it's okay as long as they're separate. That's why it's okay. Okay.
What I'm saying is, you know, maybe people want to do one because it's too expensive, it's dangerous, whatever, but not because people are going to get confused from outside or inside.
Mm-hmm. Nachon.
So what is the minhag?
First we just got to the stage of the Beit Yosef, the Torah, the Rambam, and we see how the things develop and how everything's coming together. Now we're up to 10 years later. And 10 years later, the Beit Yosef is very popular and it's spreading.
Which page are you?
The Beit Yosef. No, we're gonna move to another page now. We're actually really gonna be in the bottom of page one. 10 years later, the Shulchan Aruch, the Rav Yosef Karo, realizes that as great as his Beit Yosef is, there's a deficiency in the Beit Yosef. What's the deficiency in the Beit Yosef?
Still too complicated.
It's still too big. It's still too complex. If you want to know halacha lemaaseh, no, tell me what to do. I just want to know what to do.
It didn't
complicate things further. But it just means you have to be able to read through all this. You have to know the Gemara. You have to be able to read a Rambam, Tosfot, and understand this.
Well, that might have complicated things further. And people were just doing what they do, and all of a sudden they're like, wait, this other guy says not to do it that way.
Yeah, another Nachon.
Maybe.
So, what he decides is that he's actually going to violate the very premise of his original work. And he's going to write a thin, sparse code to codify the halakha so that everyone knows what they have to do in their practical life. And what does he call this book? The Shulchan Aruch. This is 10 years later. Let's read the Hakdama to the Shulchan Aruch.
Somebody's going to make a kid to
Shulchan Aruch. So how old is he when he started the Shulchan Aruch?
He's probably...
Because you say it took 30 years to do the Beit Yosef.
He's probably 40. In his 50s about. In his 50s.
When he started the Beit Yosef when he was 10? No,
when he's 20.
So 20, 30 years, and then 10. You said 10 years later.
Oh, 10 years later. You're right. Maybe 60. Maybe 60. He lived a long life from 1488 to 1575. Very long life in 87 years.
It's like double.
Okay. So let's look on the bottom of page one. Now we're going to read the Hakdama to the Shulchan Aruch. We're going to read his introduction to the Shulchan Aruch. Odeh Hashem me'od b'fiyu v'toch revim alenu u'mishirei ahodenu. I want to praise God amongst the in public. Ra'iti ani bilibi ki tov lo kod shoshanei sapiri. I realized that it would be very useful if I took what I wrote in the Beit Yosef, and if I would clarify it, if I would abbreviate it, if I would, you know, shorten it, okay? So that everyone can actually know the practical halacha. When you ask a scholar a question, what's the halacha? He could tell you. This is what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. This is what the halacha.
His whole issue at first, though, was that he didn't have the source.
Uh-huh. So now, but basically the whole point is you have the Shulchan Aruch, but you'll still have the Beit Yosef. So you can still find the source.
You can find the source.
But you're right.
Just be able to go through this book and not have to go through the sources.
You're right. And that's going to become the problem with the Shulchan Aruch. The very same problem with the earlier works, that they don't have the sources. People are going to start using the Shulchan Aruch almost like without understanding its sources also. And that's going to be a problem too. So the cycle repeats itself. And this is the cycle of halacha. It's a very...
Some problem that with the Rambam, the...
Uh-huh. Nachon mod, nachon. Okay, so he wants to clarify it, and then let's just go to the boldface words. V'karati sham sefer zeh Shulchan Aruch, and I wrote and I called this work the Shulchan Aruch. Ki boim tzahu ge kol minei matamim aruchim b'kol ushmerim sudarim uverim. Because in this book you'll find a set table with all these delicacies and everything, you know, displayed for you on a silver platter on a set table. This is how we get the name Shulchan Aruch. Okay? Everyone understand how we get to the title Shulchan Aruch?
What, did we know what he was thinking of the work of the other guy, of Derech?
Darkei Moshe? No. No, I don't. We don't know. Okay. I don't know.
And now... He didn't have a panic attack?
I don't know. He did not have a panic attack.
He knew about it.
Did he know about it?
Did he know? I imagine maybe he got word of it. I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. I imagine he got word of it. Maybe. And then... And then we have, what happens then? Then we have the second move by
the Rama.
The Rama. The Rama is going to also write another commentary. Okay? So let's see what this commentary is. Hakdama the Shulchan Aruch, Hakdama the Rama. Now we're going to see the Rama's Hakdama to the Shulchan Aruch. Amar Moshe ben something, Arab Yisrael, Zecher, something like that. Biot ki agaon mechaber beit Yosef Shulchan Aruch shalo chacham adif min yavi. Being that the Rav Yosef Karo is a scholar greater than a prophet. Tavach tavacho arach shulchano. He slaughtered his meat. He set his table. Lo iniach acharav makom nitgader bo. He'll have no space for one to, I don't know, to either contradict. I think it's to contradict or expand upon. To expand upon. Lulei lo kot divrei achronim ularo derech haminagim shenagum b'develu. Except for what could I do here? What could I add to this? The Rama says I could add the local custom. Ashkenazi, German, French, Polish customs. Bati acharav lifros mapa al shulchan aruch. I have come to place a tablecloth on the set table. Okay. Shechiber lehem kol primigadim umatamim asher yehav adamim. That he is already decorated with very tasty delicacies. Uvelozeh
haShulchan
asher.
This is like the Zmirat Hashem.
Yeah, there. Uvelozeh haShulchan asher huarach lifnei Hashem lo nitnu adayin lifnei Adam asher b'mizat edu. His work is incomplete for our region in Poland. We don't really follow, he says, the words of the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rabbeinu Asher. So we need our local customs. Okay? And then he gives his explanation of, you know, who he follows. He follows Halacha Kibatrai. The Halacha is like the later opinions. And he's going to explain who he's collecting from. Vehema ha'or zarua, ha'mordachi, bold-faced words. Ashri, smag, asmak, ha'gut maimon. These are all chokhmei tzorfat. These are all the opinions that he's going to take from the medieval Ashkenazim. Okay? And so he's going to quote all those opinions. So here we have, now let's look at the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, we're going to take the same sugya that we just studied, and we're going to look at the Shulchan Aruch. Let's go now to page 3, let's go to the back page 4. Okay? I made a photocopy here of the Shulchan Aruch itself. Here, back page of this one.
Okay.
Page 3 of that. Okay, right here.
So hold on. The Shulchan Aruch is written by Karo.
Also, Rav Yosef Karo.
Okay, mm-hmm. So why, I don't understand this other introduction of the other guy, of...
He writes what's called Ashkenazi glosses to the Shulchan Aruch.
And he calls it what?
He calls it the mapa, the tablecloth.
Oh, really?
And then yeah, because the Shulchan Aruch means the set table, and he provides the tablecloth. That's the whole point. It's a whole, you know, wordplay. Okay?
They're having fun, huh?
Really how they're having fun. Now let's see.
How different were the minhagim of the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim?
Well, let's see. There were some significant differences.
I thought we were proud that the Jewish people everywhere, we were
no, very I'll give you an example of a considerable difference that there are not quotes.
Well,
we'll look at this.
I'll give
you an example. Okay. I just taught this to my students. So do people wait after eating hard cheese before eating meat? We know you have to wait, after you eat meat, you have to wait 6 hours before eating dairy. Or 3 hours, whatever it is. Do you have to wait after eating hard cheese?
Half an hour generally after.
Okay, well, generally you wait, you know, you wash your mouth, half an hour, whatever it is. Right. What about hard cheese? Parmesan, blue cheese, cheddar cheese, you have to wait. Maharami Rutenberg quotes in his time that he himself was eating hard cheese and it got caught between his teeth just like meat did. So he decided to start waiting 6 hours. This is an Ashkenazi custom.
That's how it started.
Okay, that's an Ashkenazi custom. And it's quoted in the Ramah. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't quote it because this is something happening in Germany at
wait,
the time.
He starts to wait 6 hours and he just starts to wait?
Wait 6 hours.
He says six.
Well, if something is stuck in his mouth, even after 6 hours, it's going to be there. He should just clean his mouth. Whatever.
Yeah, I think he started waiting 6 hours, if I'm not mistaken.
That's interesting.
Yeah, although, wait a second. It's interesting because... Yeah, I think he says six. I have to confirm that.
Okay.
But he definitely waited until the next Su'udah or something. Although, but see, the truth is... See, the Ramah quotes three opinions in his. He quotes two opinions on this. He says some wait six, and he says v'amachmer tavolav bracha, and some just do kinuach. They end the suda, they make berkat hamazon, wash their hands, and you could eat then, you know, dairy even after meat.
So zero or six.
So yeah, but I don't see what the chidush would be if I think he's saying dafki wait like 6 hours. Okay. I'm not mistaken. Okay, so let's look at we're going to look at the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. This is not the Beit Yosef. This is the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. Now, look at the top. You see the top? That's the Shulchan Aruch. Okay? Now, do you notice that there are two different types of letters there? Do you see that some of them are bold and some of them are lighter? Mm-hmm. So the bold, that's the Shulchan Aruch. The lighter font is the Ramah of Moshe Israel. This is glosses to the Shulchan Aruch.
I mean, usually it's written in Ketav Rashi.
Yeah, sometimes it's Ketav Rashi.
When it's not with
exactly. So let's read the Shulchan Aruch. This is pure halacha. Kama neirot madlik. How many neirot? How many candles do we light? Ba'layla harishon madlik achad. In the first night you light one. Mikan ve'elach mosiv ve'olech achad b'kol layla. Each night you then add one per night. Ad shebalela acharon yushmona. Until the last night you have eight. Even if there are many people in the house, you do not light more. Whose opinion is that? So it's Tosafot, Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, but it's also the custom of Bnei Svarad, according to the Rambam. Okay, that's the custom of the Svaradim. This is the Svaradim, it's boldface. Now look at the other font, Haggah. You see those three letters, Haggah? Haggah means gloss. Okay? V'yesh Omrim, there are those who say, D'kol achad mibnei habayit yadlik. Some say that everybody in the house should light. And then there's a parenthesis here. This is a later commentator put this in. It's the Rambam. V'chein haminhag bashut. This is our custom, that everybody in the house lights. Vizaru litain kol achad v'achad neortav bimkom yuchad. Everybody should put their Chanukiah in a special place. Kedei sheyehe heker kama neirot madlikin. In order that everybody knows what night it is. And whose opinion was that to know what night it is? That's the Maharami Prank that was quoted in the Darkei Moshe. So you see here we have a condensed version of the Beit Yosef in the Darkei Moshe. And you have the halacha. Kishulchan Aruch, Sadur B'fiv, it's right here.
Right.
Okay, now, if you wanted to do, and then everything on the bottom here is commentary on the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. Okay, there's the Mishneh Berurah, which was written in the, you know, basically the 19th, 20th century. Okay, and but this is the, and that's for Ashkenazim, but this is the condensed, this is the Shulchan Aruch. And we see how we went from the Beit Yosef to the Shulchan Aruch. Now, I just want to finish with the following few things. Let's just understand a few of the qualities of the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, first of all, only focuses on practical law. It does not focus on law that's no longer relevant today. It does not write about korbanot. There's nothing about the mikdash. There's nothing about laws that do not apply today. It's only about practical law. Furthermore, he doesn't quote a variety of opinions in the Shulchan Aruch. He just quotes, I'm just telling you about the Shulchan Aruch. He doesn't quote a variety of opinions. He just quotes the halakha as it is. It's just like the Rambam in that sense. Okay? So everything that he does in the Beit Yosef, he excises from the Beit Yosef, from the Shulchan, in the Shulchan Aruch. Furthermore, there's a complete elimination of ideology, theology, and teleology. We don't know what the Shulchan Aruch's viewpoint is of the world. The Rambam we know is a rationalist, and he brings philosophy in, etc., right? The Shulchan Aruch is pure halakha. It just tells you what to do in life. It's very practical.
Tachlis.
There's nothing else. It doesn't include Kabbalah. It doesn't include anything else. It's tachlit, tells you what to do.
There is Kabbalah in the Shulchan Aruch.
When you say Shulchan Aruch, are you including the
Mappah? Even the Mappah as well. You're right, the Mappah. It's true of the Mappah as well.
So, then it doesn't tell you what to do.
Why?
Because it's two opinions.
I mean, the Shulchan Aruch, when he wrote it. I'm talking about the Shulchan Aruch when he wrote it. Exactly. Exactly. Okay? Now, let's now read.
It's interesting, the Mishnah Berurah is talking about the price of the oil and what you do when you don't have enough oil. And
Exactly.
It's interesting.
Exactly. Now, let's go to this. Rabbi Dr. Isidore Twersky, on page 2. The Shulchan Aruch, Enduring Code of Jewish Law. Because this now is an opportunity. We now, what's so exciting about this is that we get to see the process, the halachic process, from a broader macro perspective. We see how things expand, the Beit Yosef, but then they get condensed. And then there are commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, and it expands and it gets condensed, right? So let's read inside. He just captures the halachic process, the dynamic halachic process, so powerfully. So Dan, please read. It's from the first line, if Rabbi Joseph Caro.
Okay, if Rabbi Joseph Caro produced a set table, Rabbi Moshe Israelis spread a tablecloth over it. It is certain that the table would never have been universally accepted if it had not been covered and adorned with the tablecloth.
So that's what's beautiful about this, that the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, it really is a combination in the end of for Ashkenazim and Sfaradim in one work. And that's what gave it its seal of approval, because the Ramah wrote his comments on the Shulchan Aruch. Okay? So it's good for Ashkenazim and Sfaradim. Keep going.
Rabbi Moshe Yisrael's glosses, both stricture and annotation, were the ultimate validation of the Shulchan Aruch. The full dialectic has here played itself out. The radical opposition to codes
giving way
to radical codification, almost with a vengeance.
So we have radical opposition to codes, to the idea of there being a set halakha, the Beit Yosef wants you to have the halachic process, right? See everything, all the opinions. But then it goes to the opposite. The pendulum swings the other way to rigid codification. For the Shulchan Aruch is the leanest of all codes in Jewish history. From the Beit Yosef to the Shulchan Aruch, from the Baroque to the Bear. Okay? You see that? Okay, keep going. Aaron, you want to read? It is not this.
It is not this dialectal movement per se, which is novel or noteworthy, for this characterizes much of the history of post-Talmudic rabbinic literature. Attempts to compress the halakha by formal codification alternate with counterattempts to preserve the fullness and richness of both the method and substance of the halakha by engaging in interpretation, analogy, logical inference, and only then formulating the resultant normative conclusion. Any student who follows the course of rabbinic literature from the Gaonic works of the 8th century through the Mishneh Torah and Turim and on down to the Shulchan Aruch cannot ignore this seesaw tendency. The tension is ever-present and usually catalytic.
Mm-hmm.
No sooner is the need for codification met than a wave of non-codificatory work rises. A code could provide guidance and certitude for a while, but not finality.
Arvak. Okay, so the second you have a code, there's commentators on the code. And then you need to codify all the commentators, right? So it's a seesaw, it's a pendulum. Okay? Arvak, Arva Zarik, your bondsman requires a bondsman. Okay, keep going. A code.
A code, even in the eyes of its admirers, required vigilant explanation and judicious application. The heartbeat had constantly to be checked, and the pulse had to be counted. It became a part of a life organism that was never complete or static. What is striking, therefore, in the case of the Shulchan Aruch, is that the dialectical movement plays itself out in the attitudes and achievements of the same person, surfing on the sea of Talmud, rising and falling on the crests of analysis and thoughts of argumentation, and then trying to gather the water into one area to construct a dike that would produce a slow, smooth flow of its waters. The Shulchan Aruch thus offers an instructive example of the dialectical movement in rabbinic literature as a whole.
You see, so everything's captured in this story of how halacha works and how it expands and contracts. And now finally, just a little bit of a piece about his academic perspective on this. Okay, what his framework is. This whole story is important, I believe, because it expands the historical background against which the Shulchan Aruch is to be seen and cautions against excessive preoccupation with purely sociological data, with contemporary stimuli and contingencies. Okay? Basically, he's disagreeing with historians who want to look at the Shulchan Aruch as like, you know, stemming from Rav Yosef Karo's personality and his Kabbalah and etc., etc. It makes the Shulchan Aruch understandable in terms of the general history of the halachic literature and its major trends. That comes in. It provides an obvious vertical perspective, i.e. literary categories seen as part of an ongoing halachic enterprise, to be used alongside of an, at best, implicit horizontal perspective, i.e. historical pressures and eschatological hopes for an explanation of the emergence of the Shulchan Aruch. Other historians are saying, oh, the reason he wrote the Shulchan Aruch is he thought Mashiach was going to come, and it's the unique personality of the Beit Yosef and historical pressures. Dr. Tversky doesn't like that. He doesn't think it captures the depth of this process. What's going on here is an internal process within halachic writing. Okay, it teaches us about the process of halachic writing, expansion to contraction. This is strengthened by the striking parallelism between the literary careers of Moshe Israelis and Rav Yosef Karo. Their historical situations, environmental influences, social context, in a phrase of contemporary jargon, their sitzim leben, are so different, but their aspirations and attainments are so similar. So he sees, but by comparing these two figures who go through the same process of, they want to create this massive encyclopedic code and then contract it and create a code that's a practical code, we see the process of halacha and how it works, and that it's an internal process to the halachic system and not something that's necessarily determined by unique historical circumstances or by eschatological concerns or local historical stimuli in the life and times of the Shulchan Aruch. It's something much deeper to the halachic process. It's a deeper, you know, it's something much more inherent to the system. And this is what he tries to explicate in this essay. It's a fantastic essay. A lot of my research came from this essay. But this is, so this is part two. We've finished now part two of the writing of the Shulchan Aruch, the story behind the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch and Rav Yosef Karo, and how they at first the Rav Yosef Karo seems to come out on top, but then they both win. They both win in the end, right? And they're both included in the Shulchan Aruch. So for next week, we're going to study opposition to the Shulchan Aruch. That will be the topic for next week. And acceptance of the Shulchan Aruch amongst Sfaradim and Ashkenazim. How well was this work accepted? Okay, what happened to it when it went out into the world? Okay, what's going to happen? So that we will study it from a number of different perspectives, Moroccan perspective, Sephardi perspective, a little bit of the Bukharian perspective, Ashkenazi perspective, and we'll see what happens to it. So the story is not over yet, but we've finished 2 out of 3 chapters. Chazak uvaroch.
Chazak uvaroch.
Thank you for hosting.
Really, and like the process.